There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Yeah, we're live into the second hour of the show. We're here till 7 o'clock, so do come on down if you're in the vicinity, if you like your sports on a big screen with the sun setting on the horizon. Beautiful views down here and a good crowd. Then make sure you make a beeline for Barasti, where you can watch all your live sport into the wee small hours of the morning. Live-wise, we haven't got a huge amount to report. I won't lie, lads. There's not a huge amount for us to be getting our heads around live. Lots to look forward to a little later on, Dalo.
Not
on the football front, not really. Just one game which we didn't mention, Tom, was the host nation, Russia, for the World Cup in the summer. They were up against possibly the tournament favourites, Brazil. And Brazil came out 3-0 winners. Miranda on 53, Coutinho 62 on the penalty, and Paulinho, who's had a resurgence of excellent form as well. So they ran out 3-0 winners against the host nation, Russia, as well. So they're warming up very, very nicely. And obviously, we talked about this on Monday night football show at the Down Anchor, that Messi, him going into, coming out of retirement for the national team, Argentina, is this going to be his year as well? And I think that, sometimes we Arch mentioned about, sometimes players are better domestically. We saw Draxler playing for Germany, that he's not had that much game time for PSG for one reason or the other. But as an international player, outstanding. But in domestic football, some players just do not seem to, being able to give that start on 11. And also, as well, their level of performance doesn't seem to be up there. So, there's some players out there that have a lot to prove within the Russian World Cup. And also, as well, they're in the shop window. So it'll be interesting to see how these players do.
Russia doing themselves all sorts of falling out with every nation in the world at the moment. Bolster their chances in their home World Cup. Surely, if you prod them enough, there's chat when I was back in the UK. Actually, there was chat that England wouldn't go, which is preposterous. Surely,
that's politics crossing paths with sport again, isn't it, Tom?
Exactly. Yeah, you don't want to be getting down that road. That's for sure. Let's talk about Lionel Messi if we can for a few moments' time, because I was travelling back, obviously.
I thought you were going to say you was with him last night.
I wasn't with him last night, no. But I was just in the reaction to that. You know that game against Chelsea last week, mm-hmm. week before last, when basically Messi put Chelsea out of the out of the European Championships. The observations, obviously a lot of people coming out afterwards and saying, scores two, makes one, obviously one of the best. And I know I don't want to get into that whole thing of who is the best out there, Ronaldo, Messi or other, blah, blah, blah. But one thing I would add, a little observation, and you two would know better, but with all the goals that Messi has scored, I find it fascinating as well that he takes the penalty, he takes the corners.
Well,
he is 5 foot two, and you can't see him getting many. He doesn't score many goals with the head, does he?
I've never known. And also, as well, Messi. Have you not seen a couple of the footages on YouTube that he's actually took the corner and he's been on the end of his own corner as well? It's incredible, really.
Pretty quick.
I think the last person to do that was in the European Championship when under Roy Hodgson had this. He must have seen the footage of Messi and thought, oh, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll do it with Harry Kane as well. And so Harry Kane took the corners for England, our best striker within the squad. And for some reason, Roy Hodgson decided to get Harry Kane on corners. So I just hope that Gareth Southgate doesn't have the same.
It's just an observation, given the fact that, the amount of goals that he has scored, and we often compare and contrast and things like that. Now, how many more he could have scored? You mentioned with the head, but how many? That's not necessarily where the majority of scores are scored from corner. If you are hanging back,
to Dale's point, and I'm no football expert or football coach, but I would have thought that the finishing ability of Lionel Messi, he's probably not going to win too many battles against centre backs for direct goals from the corner. But you'd think around the 20-yard area, or whatever. Mm. He'd be pretty useful to pick up a rebound or pick up a misclearance and then just react to it, either beating someone or first-time shot. You think that's... you think you'd place them rather than taking... Yeah. A bit like Harry Kane. Harry Kane's a finisher, scores goals for a living, right? That's where he earns the big bucks. Mm. You want him on the end of crosses rather than taking them, right?
Well, absolutely. I think with Messi taking corners as well, though, as soon as he takes a corner, what he will do is to draw two out, because what they will do is Barcelona, they'll bring another couple of players short. So that draws players out of the penalty area. So he is still a threat. Wherever he is on the pitch, he's a threat, because if Barcelona plays a short one, if Messi plays a short one, you know, on the edge of the penalty area, that as naturally as a defender, you'll draw two players out, and that's dangerous. As soon as Messi is obviously then, you know, coming towards the penalty area, you know, just a little blind ball inside the fullback, that's where the situation is. Obviously, then if he does get the ball back, he can whip it in again as well. So it's just creating space as well within the penalty box as well. So he's probably is more effective in taking the corner.
You're listening to The Grill, broadcasting live from Barasti. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, though, we will tell you who's on pole position for the Grand Prix, the first Grand Prix of the new season. There's also live cricket for you as well. We're putting the picture of that.
This is The Grill. Get involved with the show. Text 4001 or message us for free on the Dubai Eye Messenger app.
Let's talk cricket for a while because there is live cricket ongoing. Let's deal with that live first and foremost. Let's go to what has turned out to be a fascinating but also rather fractious series between South Africa and Australia.
Yeah, day three of the third test match down in beautiful Newlands in Cape Town. It's been a feisty series, Tom, as you rightly say. 1-1 after the first two test matches, South Africa versus Australia. Lots of words said off the pitch. Bands being overturned, fast bowlers bumping batsmen. It's all been happening down under, or down in the Republic of South Africa. And it's fair to say, I think South Africa are in control now of the third test match. Just to give you a bit of an update, they're currently 151 for 3 in their second innings. AB de Villiers, 18 not out. He's just been joined at the crease by Faf du Plessis, the captain, who's yet to score. Australia were dismissed earlier today for 255, which gave South Africa a decent lead of around 60 runs in the first innings, but they've advanced it now to a lead of 207 runs, 7 wickets remaining, and South Africa firmly in the driving seat. First innings for South Africa, 311. Dean Elgar was the star there. He top scored with 140 odd. He carried his bat throughout the innings. Now he's done it three times, which each equaled a record. Markram also scored 84. Wickets to fall, or the wickets today, Elgar 14, Amla 31, and again Markram has had a good test match. He's just been dismissed for 84. So South Africa in control halfway through day three. Their lead over Australia is 207, 7 wickets remaining. If they can get up over 300 lead, you've got to say it's really tough for Australia to probably win the match batting fourth. But let's wait and see. The whole series has ebbed and flowed really nicely, and both teams have swung on the balance of power here. But South Africa currently in control of that test match in Cape Town.
Right, let's try and deal with a few of the issues down in this series at the moment. It all blew up at the end of the second day, during which Australia opener David Warner was confronted by a fan as he returned to the change room. This game being played out at Newlands, which is in Cape Town. 12 other spectators were also ejected from the ground for singing distasteful songs about Warner's wife, Candice. Darren Layman, the Australia coach, afterwards said the fans had gone too far.
They definitely bowled better today. In periods, we got in front of the game and then obviously let them back in. Those runs at the end were vital in terms of the game. So we're back in the game. We've certainly got to bowl better in the second innings. I don't think we bowled that badly, but we certainly can improve in that area. But our batting, top order batting, has got to improve. There's no doubt about that. I think it's been disgraceful. I mean, you're talking about abuse of various players and their families, and personal abuse is not on at a cricket ground anywhere around the world, not just here. It shouldn't happen. I mean, you can have the banter, that's fine. Banter's, you know, good-natured fun by crowds, but they've gone too far here. We've written to Cricket South Africa, Cricket Australia have done that. We'll see their response, but it's been poor. Yeah, it was personal, it was poor. And he wasn't the only one. They are. Look, there's always going to be banter, as we said, and Lord, it doesn't get personal, but it has gone too far with the crowd here, and they've got to be better than that when they're coming to international arena to watch a game of two quality sides playing against each other. And they go hard on the ground, there's no doubt about that, but off the ground you don't expect that when you're leaving the ground or you're having a go at someone's family. It's just disgraceful. He looked positive at times and defended well, left well. It's more of a whacker wicket, actually, to be fair. This wicket's got some carry in it, as we said, so served him down to the ground. I thought he played really well. Took a good piece of bowling from Philander to get him out, so I was pleased with his output again. He got a great start. You would love him to go on and get 100, and someone like Elgar, you know, got 130. If he does that and he's batting with batters, you know, we get closer to their total. Yeah, it's a great achievement for Mornay. He's been a great bowler over a long period of time, and we congratulate him for 300. We'd like him not to have 300 now, but he's been fantastic bowler for South Africa over many years and bowled really well today and got some key wickets early. So that's what he's done over his career. He managed height, bounce, pace, aggression, bowled really well with the reverse today as well. So, you know, we've got to play him better in the second innings, but we do congratulate him because it's a great achievement, 300. He's been a fantastic bowler for South Africa over a long period of time.
All right, let's pick the bones out this one. So, Darren Lehman, not happy. As he mentioned there, Cricket Australia have lodged an official complaint with Cricket South Africa, who beefed up security in response. However, the only reaction from the South African camp so far was fast bowler Morne Morkel, you heard there, being referenced there, urging fans not to, I quote, get out of line. Since then, Graham Smith and Mark Boucher, the former South African captain and the veteran wicketkeeper, have both gone public, effectively saying that Lehman, was saying to Lehman that the Australian crowds were the same, if not worse. I quote, they say, correct, Darren, fully agree, but start cleaning up in your own country first. The personal racial abuse I've witnessed in Australia was ridiculous. You guys don't live in a glass house. Why the fuss all of a sudden? Seems fine when the shoe is on the other foot. Fair?
Yes, to a degree. Firstly, let me preface what I'm about to say by saying, yeah, there's no place for personal abuse and bad chanting and things that get very sort of over the top in cricket grounds. That being said, Tom, have you ever been to a test match in Australia?
I have, yes.
The crowd aren't exactly pacifists. They aren't exactly sitting back enjoying the action and not saying anything. They get involved. They get amongst it. And many a boundary fielder, or if you're an Englishman there, they don't hold back. They give as good as they get. And I just feel by Australia now continually referencing the situation, it just adds a bit of gasoline to the fire. It just winds the crowd up even more. It winds up the ex-players even more to say, well, hang on, isn't this the pot calling the kettle black here? Because if you've ever been to a test match in Australia, the crowd get right into it and give you plenty. And, you know, it's a funny time to start now referencing it individually. Look, there is no place for personal abuse. Some of the things that have probably been said is bang out of order, but it's Australia. They invented sledging. It's where it comes from.
Let's get the thoughts of this is Graham Smith. He's also taken to Twitter to give his thoughts on the whole thing. He responded to Mark Boucher's tweet that we just read out there. He tweeted saying, look, absolutely right, and I don't condone any of it, but blimey, I've never seen an Aussie team whinge and whine like this. Now, those are two words that are usually reserved for English teams down under, whinging and whining pommies or whatever. Is there something in that at the moment? Because they do seem to be... Australia are usually one of those teams that do their talking out on the field. They let the results do the talking. There's so much chat in and around this series. I think they've been rattled.
Yeah, and they've lost that last test match convincingly against South Africa and the behind the eight ball in this match as well. So they're looking for reasons. They're fumbling around for excuses, and they're not used to losing. They're not used to being in the position where they're on a back foot. And they're fighting back with a lot of talk, as you expect from them. But, you know, you don't expect it from the coach and the senior players. And look, there is no place for it, whatever the banter is. And if it has gone over the top, then I'm guessing it has gone way over the top, because anything around the limit is probably fair game. So there must be a lot of things being said. Obviously, there's chants taking place. But look, you know, we're used to things like the Barmy Army. They go to cricket grounds in Australia and all around the world, and they sing songs and chant about players, and the Aussie crowds give it back to them. And it's generally quite good-hearted and witty and funny and a bit of banter. And it doesn't usually cross the line. Whatever the line is, it doesn't always tend to cross it. Now, the Australians are going, well, this is, you know, we're not happy with what's been going on. Official complaints have been lodged. But again, as I say, they invented sledging. They made this an art form. And now that it's on the other foot, they don't seem to be enjoying it. So again, it's the whole David Warner situation again. He's happy enough to give it when he's got his teammates around him. But if someone gives it back to him, then he's gone off the rocker.
You know, you and I have played in front of a few fans, Arch, but none on the scale that the man alongside us, Dale Gordon, has in the past. And Dale, I mean, who better to ask? You know, you go, you know, you play at home, you play away, you play in front of fans from all around different parts of the world, etc. Different cultures, different approaches to the game. This whole thing of banter in sport, I would argue there is no fine line. There is no line. You know, there is.
They talk about sledging and stuff, and they talk about being personal. Well, the whole point of sledging and banter is to be personal, is to get in someone's head.
Yeah.
So it's not whether it's personal or not. All sledging, all chat on a sports field is personal to some degree or not, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the players in the Premier League, I think it was the beginning of the season, and by his own supporters as well, and they had to put a stamp on it, and that was Lukaku in Manchester United. We won't go too much into it, but, you know, it was probably when somebody who's obviously just joined the football club was going through, he started well, went through a little bit of a barren spell, and I think that it obviously got to him, got in his head a little bit, and his level of performance, you know, was reflected in that as well. And even Paul Pogba, you look at the advertising hoardings around Manchester United, you know, and Alex, in the Alex Ferguson days, none of that would have been seen, you know. But you draw it to you, half the players actually draw it to themselves, you know, bring it on themselves. And I think that, yeah, look, I've had it. Look, you get banter, you get slagged off, you get praise, being a winger, an old style winger as well, used to hug the touchline. Yeah, you, God, dearie me, I've had things thrown at me as well. I always remember a game, a testimonial game, which was Tim Shepherd's, the physio at Norwich City, invited Martin O'Neill's Celtic team to come down to Norwich. I mean, you know, and obviously myself and Robert Fleck, another ex Norwich, ex Rangers player, we were due to go on the second half, and the police wouldn't let us on. And this is a testimonial game because Celtic had the whole of the South Stand, which was about 8,000 or 9,000 Celtic supporters, and I had to go on the right wing. And I said, "Listen," "listen, officer, it's not a problem. I played them bigger than this, you know." And I went on the other side, Tom, and I must have come off the pitch with about £50. Do you know what I mean? It was like coins for fun. Do you know what I mean? Don't get me wrong. There's no Scotsman threw any notes at me. It was all coins.
On that point, Dale, you've taken part in what's known globally as one of the most vicious football derby matches, environments that
religious
any footballer,
as well.
And it goes way beyond sport.
Yes.
It's religious.
Yes.
It's social. It's it's everything. It's two teams in one city with Glasgow and Celtic.
Yep.
Things that must be said and historical references. There's no holds barred in that type of environment. And as a player, you just, what do? You just get on with it, right? You're a professional. You're paid to do your job, and you know what you're going to get, and you just get on with it. You can't give it back, really. No. You can be Gazza and try and play to it a bit, but you're taking, you know what you can do and what you can't do, surely.
Yeah, of course, and we won't go too much into the political side of it for obvious reasons, but I think that, you've got to be thick-skinned, and I think that with the Celtic and the Rangers games, arguably one of the biggest games in world football, historically, derby wise anyway. And I think that you know, there has been in recent years UEFA have stamped out, and I also think because of the foreign influx of players as well, it went through a spell where it became a little bit more, I would say more gentle, but it wasn't as loud and as vicious as it has been in previous years. I mean, I played in five, and I had the privilege to play in five, and the build-up to the game was just incredible. You know, the whole week build-up, and ex-players would come out, and the importance of the game. And really, Rangers are going through what Celtic went through years ago when I was playing it. They didn't win a derby game for so many years. And, I was privileged to play in five, never lost, never had the... But the abuse was just incredible. You just didn't know. I remember John Collins was at the outside left, at the old Celtic ground now, and before that it was all renovated. There was a side down the side. It was called the Jungle, and John Collins was on the left. And Richard Gough said to me, "Dale, this is my first ever Old Firm game. Whenever the ball comes to you, just get rid of it." I said, "What do you mean, Goffey? Just when the ball comes here, just kick it, just header it, just get rid of it, just get put that." I said, "But Goffey, I can play a little bit, mate." So I took one on my chest. John Collins came in. This is after about 5 minutes. I completely took John Collins' legs away from him, obviously not on purpose. And the Jungle just completely just swarmed me. And the referee came over, yellow card, 5 minutes into my debut, and Richard Gough comes screaming over. I think he gave me more abuse than what the Celtic supporters done for actually try to control the ball in an Old Firm game. You just don't control it. You get it, you get rid of it. But it was just, incredible, incredible times. And it happens, like you said, with the cricket as well. I'm sure, and I think we recently, obviously with the Ashes as well, that the Aussies were giving it out massively to the English, weren't they? So they, you know, they have to obviously be on the back end of that as well. So
take as good as you get. Give us your thoughts on that one. 4001. We're going to go to a break. We're going to play out with the thoughts of Mornay Morkel to that break. Why? Because he's just broken another record. Is that right?
He's just taken his 300th Test wicket. He announced his retirement from international cricket after the series. He's come back into the team, taken four wickets, including his 300th Test wicket. I think the fifth South African bowler to do so. He's been a great stalwart for South Africa. Let's just listen to his thoughts after day two at the third Test match in Cape Town.
Yeah, it's a special feeling, you know, especially because I'm the world record holder for the most nobles. So, you know, when I got the first one, I had to turn around and see if it was a legal delivery, the second one, the third one. So, yeah, to eventually, you know, to reach it, this is something I've worked hard for a long time. And, you know, to get it to this amazing venue made it even better. You know, my body's still feeling great. Mentally, I'm still feeling fantastic. You know, for me, it was just, you know, coming into this game, I haven't played for, what is it, 10 days, 11 days, so I've done all the work, but game time, is, like we all know, is very important. So I felt a little bit rusty at times, but for me, it was just, the most important was just to stay in my bubble and just focus on keeping it simple. Yeah, but, you know, for the future, for me, like I said, you know, I'm still feeling good. I mean, I can still play, you know, for a couple of years, but, you know, it is a family decision at the end of the day, and I've made that call. And yeah, I think once you've made your mind up, you know, you can't really turn back on that decision. And I'd rather go out on a high now than, you know, having a couple of average games. And yeah, the love is gone. There's still a second innings. There's still a test match to be won, and then, you know, still one more in Joburg, and that's my focus. I said at the start of the series, I want to be part of this team, you know, beating Australia for the first time in South Africa, and you know, that's my focus and that's my goal, and you know, hopefully we can end up in the knife.
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Yeah, live from Barasti, where it's kicking off at the moment. It's that witching hour. Myself, Mark Archer, Dale Gordon up here on the rooftop garden, observing all that goes on below. It's that witching hour, isn't it, Dale, when the sun starts to go down?
Does strange things to you.
It does strange things to people.
Absolutely.
And, you know, people are now making that decision. Should we, you know, it's a school night. Should we be going home and getting ready for work? Oh, it's not, actually.
Exactly.
School holidays.
Yeah, school holidays.
Crack on.
Exactly.
Let's have it.
So, literally, what you're trying to say, Tom, there's probably about 3,000 school teachers down on the beach at the moment.
lots to look forward to down here at Barasti. If sport is your thing, get yourself down here, because you can watch live sport on any of their 20-plus screens. And, of course, where better to watch it in high definition on the big screen itself. They have the international friendlies up there a little later on. Let's talk cricket, or continue to talk cricket, with Mark Archer. How did England get it so wrong in their first innings against New Zealand?
It's a good question, Tom, and if you can answer that, you're probably doing a good
I
job.
I know.
Then.
Phil Tufnell's T-shirt.
Phil Tufnell's T-shirt.
Well, that was the criticism, wasn't it? They were undercooked for this. They hadn't played enough white ball. They hadn't played enough whites, Test cricket.
Well, yeah.
Long format cricket.
Well, that's what happens in the winter. They went to Australia, got a pretty comprehensive defeat. Then they then send a lot of the players are playing all the limited overs cricket and the T20 cricket and all those series. Some of the test players went back and put their feet up for a while. Jimmy Anderson, Stuart Broad, Mark Stoneman. These guys all went back and relaxed. Alistair Cook go back and have a Christmas and a New Year and have a relaxing time. Came back to New Zealand, played a couple of quick warm up 2-day matches. And then the first test match, Eden Park, Auckland, pink ball, day-night action. Kane Williamson, New Zealand captain, wins the toss, puts England in. And what happens? All bowled out for 58, Tom. They were 28 for 9 at one stage until Craig Overton chipped in from number 9 with 33, not out. But the next best English score was 11. 5 batsmen recorded ducks. Obviously, there's some good bowling by the New Zealanders, Trent Bolton particularly, with 6 for 32. But they can't have been that bad a wicket, Tom, because New Zealand went out and batted in probably what they say was the tougher conditions, under lights, ball should be swinging around more, And Kane Williamson, the captain, went and scored at 18th Test century New Zealand record, 102 he scored. And New Zealand have gone on to score 233 for four. So the wicket can't be that bad. Conditions can't be that bad. Well, the England batsmen are apparently still on holiday, but they have done one thing really well, Tom, is that they must have performed a heck of a rain dance because it's rained for 2 days and they haven't got back out on the pitch.
It's a draw.
and it's looking like a draw now because the weather's intervened. But, yeah, England pretty terrible out for 58.
Let's talk about the preparation for this one because that's what most of the critics are saying. Are you a fan of these Mickey Mouse games, the warm-up games when you just bat? I mean, that warm-up game...
13 players bat. There was no sort of... It's not a first-class match.
14 wickets fell.
Yeah. And there were two-day matches, which is basically one innings each per team. Lots of players got a bat. Obviously, bowlers were still put through workloads. And they tried to play with a pink ball in preparation. Look, some of those English players have played lots of cricket. Johnny Bairstow's played all the formats. Ben Stokes has now played all those series but hasn't played a lot of test cricket. Some of those players are the same guys. Joe Root's been there throughout the whole series there, so he's had plenty of cricket as well. But I guess it's showing that the England test side didn't have enough preparation. And they don't play a lot of cricket with this pink ball, but then again, both teams haven't played a lot of cricket.
First one, isn't it? First day night test?
No.
First day night test for in New Zealand?
No, I think there might have been one more before.
First day night.
Okay, but England have played a couple, New Zealand have played a couple. They don't play this regularly, the pink ball the day night. They're trying to bring crowds in the evenings, and you can see why they're trying to do it. It's the same for both teams, Tom. The pitch is the same for both teams. The ball's the same for both teams. England, for some reason, just a lot worse. 58, terrible.
Now listen, if England go on and lose this series, I'm of the opinion, I'm interested to get your opinion, that questions have to be asked about Trevor Bayliss and Test cricket. Take nothing away from his one-day record at the moment. Take nothing away from that whatsoever. But I just don't understand. He's not got a great test record. He, by his own admission, says he doesn't really like the test format. He's more of a one-day man, and he knows how to get the best out of his players, which he's obviously doing there. With the World Cup of tests on the horizon and things like that, and England desperately needing to improve their the way they play test cricket and whites cricket away from home, something's got to be done, surely.
Yeah, but what do you do? Where do you go for the batsman? We know there's a couple of weaknesses in that English test order there. We know Alistair Cook's a shoo-in. We know Joe Root's locked his slot in there. We know Ben Stokes and is a lock-in. Johnny Bairstow's a lock-in. But there's a couple of places there. David Milan's come in and done an okay job. They're still short of, who's going to open the batting with Alistair Cook? Who's going to bat three regularly? There's still some weaknesses there that it can be easily pointed to in the England lineup. Stuart Broad's been around a long time. Jimmy Anderson's been around a long time. They need some new blood in there, maybe with the bowling attack at some stage as well. So are the players there? Are there lots of players in county cricket who are saying, I'm scoring all the runs and pick me?
Yeah, I was going to say, is what's the situation with youth of cricket in the UK?
They've brought in a new... Andrew Strauss mentioned earlier in the week that they've brought in a new scouting system. Mm-hmm. So they've moved away. They're trying to get more transparency in the selection process. So rather than just picking horses for courses, making sure that you're picking the right players for the right games, be that in England or abroad as well. Having said that, I think they've got it completely wrong here because I look back at the series in Australia... and the early part of this series over in New Zealand, and who's been the difference for England in the one day format? One of the differences for them has been Mark Wood. Why? Because he bowls in bursts. He's quick. He's the quickest of the bowlers that they've taken there down there, and he just offers something a little bit different with the players they've gone with. And wouldn't you think you'd throw in that sort of
problem with Mark Wood and again fast bowlers. And we sort of talked about it earlier in the show is. Test cricket, you need to last 5 days. You can't bowl in T20 cricket 4 overs. You can't also bowl like 50 overs, 10 overs and get away with it. You have to be prepared to bowl a day where you bowl 15, 16 to 20 overs. And if you get injured as a bowler in a test match, you can't come back. You can't be replaced. You're done for 5 days and your team is at a massive disadvantage. Now, if you're carrying a fast bowler that's at injury problems, until you're convinced he's proven his fitness that he can bowl 15, 16, 17 overs a day, you can't pick him because you can't take the risk that you're going to go a man down and survive a test match with an injured bowler. And that's the problem with a guy like Mark Wood now. He's almost specialising in you know, 50 over cricket, because you only got to bowl 10 overs, and your body's used to that. To not play any, but here's the problem. If you haven't been playing first class cricket and bowling 15, 16, 17, 18 overs a day, then you're not ready, because it's very hard to replicate that in the nets. You know, bowling that, you can do it, but it's tough to do. You're not in the middle. So that's why the risk of picking guys with injury problems as fast bowlers is tough, right?
He's just brings something a little bit different. You know, Overton saved them with the bat in the first, if there is such a thing as saving, with a total of 58. But he's just too predictable as a bowler. Stuart Broad has changed he's gone back to basics with his bowling style and things like that. He's looking to try and prolong his career. I just think that, you know, and if Mark Wood can bowl 10 overs in a one-day international and be one of the picks, then what, you know, you're asking for 10 overs a day. That's all you're asking from him, because he bowls in short, because of his style anyway, he bowls in short bursts, 3-4, but he's one of those players that a captain can go to and say, go on, Woody, do something different for us.
Yeah, but as a lead strike bowler, he's not like your Ben Stokes as your all-rounder who can come and bowl 10 overs or 8 overs. As an opening bowler, you've got to bowl more than that. You've got to give more. You've got to bowl 85, 90 overs in a day. So if one guy's bowling 10, you've still got to get 80 overs out of it. Without the lack of a really good spinner who can tie up an end like Graham Swan, probably the last Englishman to do so, you've got to rotate those fast bowlers. So where's it going to come from? You've still got to bowl 80 overs in a day. And if two of your other opening bowlers can bowl 15, well, that's 30, and you're giving Mark Wood 10 at 40, you've still got to bowl 40, 50 overs. Who's going to do it? You need guys that can bowl spells. But anyway, things aren't all well with the England and their setup. One player that things are going well for is the New Zealand captain, Kane Williamson. Took a stunning catch. I don't know if you saw the catch. He took it off Stuart Broad in the gully. Stuck it, going past him, caught it right-handed, diving away. Fantastic catch. Off Stuart Broad was batting.
Oh, right.
Stuart Broad was batting. Flashed it a wide one. But
very good of Kane to come on and field for us. What, we were a man down, weren't we?
Wow. He's a good guy, Kane Williamson, but then he went out and showed
looking to get Broadie to his, because he got a landmark, didn't he? He was on 399 for
a while.
I think
got 400 test wickets, didn't he? He got him out. But Kane Williamson is still a youngster, one of the more talented players in world cricket, leading the light as the captain. He scored 102, so he's doubled the England score by himself when he batted. He scored an 18th test century, which is New Zealand record. He's gone past Martin Crowe, who was obviously a very, very famous New Zealand batsman, and also gone past Ross Taylor, who's currently in the side. Let's listen to Kane Williamson talking about the match and his innings of 102.
Yeah, it's not really something I think a huge amount about. Martin was a fantastic, world-class player for New Zealand, our best player, batsman certainly of all time. And the respect is certainly there for Martin, what he's done for the game. If for me personally, I've never focused too much on stats. It's always been about trying to do my bit or my best for the team, and that's why today it was frustrating to not sort of still be out there. Saying that, it was a fairly good delivery and you walk off and that's part and parcel of the game, but you want to keep going and trying to contribute more and more, really.
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
If you're near a phone, if you're near a device, get yourself onto Twitter. Check out at Barasti Beach, at Dubai Eye Sport, and at the Kiwi Oracle. Mark Archer always tweets before the show. Arch, I think you might have gone too far on this occasion, though. I'm pretty sure that Dale Gordon's legal team will be in touch with you after the show.
I thought it was perfectly susceptible. I just put into my Twitter account, great to be down here at Barasti with Tom Urquhart, with Dale Flash Gordon. Put a picture of
Gordo.
Dale
I know that
Flash
you're not on
Gordon
you're not on Twitter,
here.
So there
we didn't give him a big. We didn't give him a big.
No, that's me. That's me in drag. that's definitely me in drag. And in fact, Flash Gordon has actually got a better tan than me.
If you push play, it's even more amusing. So we didn't give Dale the liberty of a musical entourage, you know, this week, introduction. So I thought I'd just put a piece on Twitter to celebrate having Dale on the show, having a genuine superstar
thanks, Arch, on the
weekend.
Thanks, Arch. I love you too, darling.
Archie. Listen, this game between South Africa and South Africa and Australia is the game, it's the series that keeps giving, Arch. There's been more scandal.
Well, just when you thought we've had enough of controversy and sledging and players being banned, we've had something else, Tom. It's just emerged on through Crick Info and through TV cameras that Cameron Bancroft, the Australian opening batsman, has been allegedly caught ball tampering. TV pictures have shown that he had a some sort of, it looked like a bit like a guitar pick, you know, a little piece of something, plastic, in his pocket. He has been shown doing something with the ball. As he was approached by the umpires to chat to him about working on the ball, this small yellow object was being seen to be put down his underpants. He did pull out from his pocket a sunglass cover and said, this is what I have in my pocket. But yet the TV cameras and Twitter, as we know with social media, is very quick to pick up on these things, and it has been shown capturing, taking it from his pocket and seemingly placing it down his trousers, Tom. So I don't think we've heard the last of this ball tampering, allegedly ball tampering incident coming from Cape Town. Literally.
Good text message that's just come in about this, though, because asking the question, why don't they just replace the ball? Obviously, that would take away the advantage, knowing that something fishy definitely happened, as everyone's seen the vigorous rubbing and then the ball reverse swinging. Would that be in the umpire's remit to replace the ball if there has been a tampering?
If they think the ball's been tampered with and it has affected it, yeah, they're perfectly within their right to replace the ball with a like-for-like replacement. But yes, I guess all these things haven't yet come to light. But again, TV cameras don't really lie these days. And particularly being in South Africa, where you've got the advantage of lots of different angles and Australian producers and editors on the show, as being the host broadcaster, are showing Cameron Bancroft again take a small yellow object that was seen in his hands working on the ball. He's now placed it somewhere else down his trousers, and the umpires have had a word to him. So I guess this one's for the match referee, who's had a busy old series. Jeff Crowe, I think, is the match referee, with lots of incidents on and off the field, and he's just got another incident to deal with here. So Cameron Bancroft, relatively new and inexperienced to the Australian lineup, but the spotlight will be on Mr. Bancroft and the yellow object that's disappeared down his trousers.
I'm just reading the live commentary coming through on Crick Info, and they have just posted this saying, just had a chance to revisit those Bancroft picks, and there's clearly something afoot there. The soft cloth that he presented to the umpires was most definitely not the yellow object that he stuffed down his underpants. This one isn't going away in a hurry. Are they still on the field?
Are they on the field? Yeah, they're definitely still on the field.
So have we ever had an instant? Would Mr. Bancroft be required to undress in front of the third umpire or the match official when they come in?
Possibly. They might ask him where that small yellow device has actually disappeared to. But let's wait and see. I guess allegations of ball tampering in one form or another is going to come to light very shortly from Cape Town and Newlands.
Fascinating. We've got live Super Rugby on for you at the moment, so we're going to bring you up to date with all the latest from that. Let's just finish with a bit of cricket for you, though, because we talked about Kane Williamson. He's been smashing it to all corners for New Zealand. The man who's taken the wickets for England, or done the damage for England in that New Zealand innings, is, of course, Jimmy Anderson, the old war horse that is Jimmy Anderson.
Yeah, Jimmy Anderson's one guy who's held his hand up, and you would have thought this pink ball and the swinging conditions in New Zealand would be suiting Jimmy Anderson. He picked up a couple of wickets, but let's hear. He still thinks England can salvage something out of the Test match.
Yeah, I can't remember an hour like that before that I've experienced like that. Whether it's being none or one down and then being bowled out, I just certainly the start of a game. And you know, it's just one of those things, like the stars aligned, and when you're not on top form, and two world-class bowlers are on top form, then that's going to happen. And it's something that, you know, we've got to try and work very hard to make sure it doesn't happen again. We have to keep believing that. If we don't have belief, then there's no point turning up and putting in the hard yards and bowling the overs in the middle. We've got to believe that we can get something out of this game. You know, we came to the ground today fully focused on trying to bowl them out, knowing the new ball was around the corner, focusing on trying to, you know, pitch the ball up and make them play as much as possible. I thought we did that relatively well, and yeah, tomorrow's going to be exactly the same. Go to bed tonight and focused on how we're going to get the remaining six wickets as quickly as possible.
Thoughts of Jimmy Anderson there, as England are up against it, down in a very, thankfully, wet New Zealand. It was always wet season down there, isn't it?
Well, not
where they playing?
Playing in Eden Park, Auckland. Okay. Of course, they've got the drop in pitch because you've got Super Rugby going on. They've dropped the pitch in for this match. The weather has held up the New Zealand pressing on with that lead at the moment. But just to give you an update there, so New Zealand's lead is 175 runs, but they've only got 2 days remaining now to get a result in this match. England may be saved after their best performance to date has actually been the rain dance, Tom, to keep the rain in. So let's wait and see.
Plenty of cricket on throughout the week as well. We've had our World Cup qualifiers. A lot of critics saying that it makes a bit of a mockery of the fact that we've got none of the emerging nations taking place in a reduced World Cup. But we have had this World Cup qualifiers. What's the big story to come out of it?
Well, the big news, to cut things short, is literally, again, is congratulations to the West Indies and Afghanistan, who have qualified for the next year's 10-team ICC World Cup to be held next year in the United Kingdom. West Indies got there courtesy of a rain-affected victory against Scotland in their final Super 6 match. They qualified. And Afghanistan, a couple of days ago, they won a thriller against Ireland to qualify. So commiserations to the other teams that didn't make it. Scotland, Ireland, host Zimbabwe, and, of course, the UAE didn't qualify. But the UAE take some credit. They got their kept their ODI status, and they also defeated the host Zimbabwe, who are a full member, in their final match to come away with a few positives there. So it's good news for West Indies and Afghanistan. A lot of people say it's not great news for cricket when a lot of those teams like Ireland and Zimbabwe, Scotland to a degree, could possibly compete well at a cricket World Cup, but they're not going to be there. ICC have decided to grow the game via T20 rather than 50 over cricket. And so that means that just before we talked about Afghanistan, also the PSL finals tomorrow, Tom, Islamabad will take on Peshawar at the National Stadium of Karachi. Good to see cricket, good standard of cricket back in Pakistan for that. But let's just have a quick listen to a summary of what's been going on in the cricket world, but particular emphasis to Afghanistan, who have qualified. An amazing story for Afghanistan in qualifying for the 10-team World Cup next year.
In a tightly fought Super 6 encounter at Harare, Afghanistan eventually prevailed over Ireland by 5 wickets to go through to the finals of the World Cup qualifiers and join the West Indies as the other team to book their berth for the ICC World Cup 2019. In a do-or-die encounter for both teams, Ireland won the toss and elected to bat and could manage a fighting 209 for 7 after Afghanistan star spinner Rashid Khan returned with figures of 3 for 40. In response, Afghanistan were cruising at one stage after their openers Mohammad Shahzad and Gulbuddin Nayib gave them a good start, but Ireland pulled things back dramatically in the middle overs. However, Afghan skipper Asghar Stanikzai kept his nerve and saw his team home to a famous victory with 5 balls to spare. After yet another gripping day of Test cricket at Cape Town, hosts South Africa find themselves ahead of Australia courtesy of a superb bowling display from their pace trio of Monty Morkel, Kagiso Rabada and Verdun Philander. Australia finished the day at 245 for 9, but at one stage were in trouble at 175 for 8 before a crucial 9th wicket partnership of 66 runs between Nathan Lyon and Tim Payne. Opener Cameron Bancroft also played an important hand, scoring 77. Earlier, South Africa were dismissed for 311 in their first innings with the help of Dean Elgar's unbeaten 141. A gritty unbeaten 141 by Elgar in the third test against Australia at Cape Town not only helped South Africa post a competitive 311 in their first innings, but has also put him in illustrious company, that of the great Desmond Haynes. After the former West Indies cricketer, Elgar has now become only the second player to carry his bat for the third time in the history of Test cricket. Before this, Elgar had previously carried the bat recently in the Johannesburg Test against India in January and against England at Durban in 2015. A stupendous performance by Monty Morkel on the second day of the Cape Town Test saw him get to the landmark of 300 Test scalps. Morkel began the series 6 wickets away from the landmark and was dropped for the second Test after taking 3 at Kingsmead in Durban. Morkel, who has already announced that he will be retiring from international cricket, has now become the 5th South African bowler to reach 300 wickets. He is also the 5th on the list of most wickets taken by a South African bowler in Tests. By scoring his 18th century in the first test against England at Auckland, skipper Kane Williamson has become the leading century maker for New Zealand in the longest format of the game. On day 2 of the first test, which was highlighted by persistent rain, Williamson came into the match tied on 17 centuries with Martin Crowe and current colleague Ross Taylor, surpassing both of them on his way to 102 before being dismissed.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.